Okay, we'll now hear the case of Russell versus Superior Court of Montreal. Mr. Jimenez, may we proceed?
Good morning. My name is Paul Jimenez. I'm here for the appellant's Superior Court and Deputy Chris Richardson in this case. Initially, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of time.
Granted.
May it please the court. You've asked a question concerning jurisdiction under either the 11th Amendment or the Revised Organic Act. And I don't think there's any question that the jurisdiction here falls under the Revised Organic Act. Section 2B. Although my co-counsel mentioned the 11th Amendment frequently in his brief, I think the Revised Organic Act Section 2B is the 11th Amendment type jurisdiction, and that the collateral order doctrine and jurisdiction on 1291 covers the court's ability to hear this case.
Have we addressed that previously?
I don't think there's been a direct determination as to the 11th Amendment, but as we all know, the Revised Organic Act specifically provides for certain amendments to be applicable to the Virgin Islands, and the 11th Amendment is not among them. Although there have been prior cases, I believe, where a Section 2 of the jurisdiction has been asserted.
But your argument, in essence, is the same principles that animate the collateral order doctrine is applied to interlocutory appeal of denial of 11th Amendment immunity applies just as well as statutory immunity.
Correct. The Cohen cases, the Mitchell, Nixon v. Fitzgerald, none of them have distinguished between the source of the collateral order, the source of the immunity. They've all basically said because there is immunity, and immunity is an important question, it's subject to interlocutory appeal.
Can we turn then to the question of the absolute immunity and quasi-judicial immunity? Specifically, are you arguing that any public official acting pursuant to a court directive is immune from suit, or only if that action is a ministerial action?
Well, I think I'm arguing both. In this particular case, there's been a number of cases in the Third Circuit that have addressed the issue. And, in particular, Waits versus McGowan has said that performance of a ministerial duty pursuant to a statute or performance of a ministerial duty pursuant to the order of a court are both subject to absolute immunity. It's also been found that the exercise of the discretionary judgment or performance of a function otherwise closely allied to the judicial process are also entitled to quasi-judicial immunity.
But if that were the case, then every time federal agents were executing a search warrant or an arrest warrant, they would be covered by absolute immunity. That would be a sea change in our approach to constitutional violations alleged as to the execution of those searches or arrests.
And certainly I have seen a number of cases involving the use of what is claimed to be excessive force in the performance of a search warrant.
Yes, Your Honor. In this particular case, we have kind of a unique circumstance, though. Although there are a couple of cases in this jurisdiction, Muhammad versus U.S. Marshals Service and Banks, which found that U.S. Marshals acting pursuant to a court order were entitled to quasi-judicial immunity, we have a circumstance here where we have territorial marshals who are not employees of the executive branch, but employees of the judicial branch, and who, although they have broad law enforcement authority under their statutory mandate, are more or less attached intricately to the functions of the court. They are required by law to execute the orders of the court. They are required by law to
distinguished on the basis of who is issuing the paycheck, that is, whether it's the judicial branch or executive branch, but rather the specific act that's covered by the order versus the manner of pursuing that act. And why shouldn't we focus on that distinction here, where even if the act of bringing someone in is itself covered, if it's conducted in a manner that involves excessive force, that is back in the realm of traditional qualified immunity, not absolute immunity?
I think the other circuits in this circuit, when they discuss the quasi-judicial immunity, have focused on the function of the individual. And many of the cases involve parties who are actually employees of the court or who have been assigned by the court to perform certain functions that are part and parcel of the judicial process. The fact that the order that's being executed may not have been done so perfectly, I don't think should take this out of the realm of quasi-judicial immunity. In particular, when you look at the Valdez case, which is in our brief and the cases that it collects, it talks about sheriffs and various other law enforcement officers executing orders who may or may not have to exercise the discretion to do things that were not provided for in the order, but still being subject to the quasi-judicial immunity defense.
But Valdez itself goes on to say an official performing ministerial acts with less than due care may be liable for damages. And the Tenth Circuit in Martin just a few years later was very clear that the immunity granted in Valdez protects defendants from liability for the actual arrest and does not empower them to execute the arrest with excessive force.
Right, but I don't think that that's actually the functions test that's been envisioned by the Supreme Court. I think if you start looking at the result of what happens when you follow the court order, that you convert the test from one of quasi-judicial immunity to one of liability, because one officer that performs that executes the order perfectly gets the immunity, but the other one that maybe doesn't meet with resistance or has a defendant or a subject that causes them to use force against them doesn't get the same immunity because of the circumstances created by the individual against whom the order is being executed.
But if we're going to look at circumstances, that's exactly where qualified immunity comes into play. And we're not talking here about something less than perfect. When a teenager is rendered a quadriplegic, that is far less than perfect. That is simply unacceptable as a consequence of being called by a mother to bring a child into court.
With qualified immunity, if there is an issue of fact as to what actually happened, as to whether it was reasonable, qualified immunity does not apply. That it has to go to the fact finder. And isn't the situation similar here, that it may, a finder of fact may indeed determine that what was done was reasonable in view of the suspect barging through the door and trying to run away, but that as a matter of law, you can't say that what the plaintiff contends happened and what the defendant contends happened. The plaintiff says this is unreasonable, the defendant says it is reasonable. There is an issue of fact, and for that reason, qualified immunity cannot be granted at this stage.
Right. I think I've got two separate questions. So with respect to,
I'm not talking about qualified immunity here. Well, I mean, that's another issue. But that it's analogous, an analogous situation to qualified immunity if there is an issue of material fact.
With respect to the
what
actually happened,
to the way that the order to arrest was carried out, that it was unreasonable.
I think with the qualified immunity part of this argument, Your Honor, if it got that far. Yes.
Well, I'm not talking about qualified immunity. I'm talking about following an order of the court. But if there is an issue of material fact, you cannot say that quasi-judicial immunity should apply here because there are issues of fact that have to be determined by the finder of fact.
I don't think that that's the way the functional approach is intended to work, however. It's, you know, the courts have said that it's a very rare circumstance where there is a factual issue that will stop the legal determination as to whether the function involved in the case is quasi-judicial immunity.
Yeah, but where do you draw the line? I think Judge, both of my colleagues sort of tried to get to that in a different way. Where do you draw the line here? I mean, this is an order for a, this is an order here from the court to go out and bring Mr. Thompson before the court. And, you know, how's that different? Where do you draw a line between that and an arrest warrant, which is issued by the court, but it's issued because a probable cause was shown in an application?
I think you take all the factors as a whole, considering that there was a court order, that these are employees of the court, that they're intricately involved in the operations of the court, and that they are obligated by law, as in Muhammad versus U.S. Marshal Service, to follow the orders of the court, and you decide where quasi-judicial immunity applies, and you take heed of the admonishment of the Supreme Court that says, sometimes bad things happen, and that's the price that we pay. We have to accept that in order to make sure that the functions of the judicial system continue to be performed unhampered.
But the order of the court was to bring Mr. Thompson back to court. The order of the court here, this was not a situation where, as we had in Morales, where the court itself ordered the excessive force be used. So we're not even in the realm of that, the manner in which it was being conducted being something directed by the court. The arguments you're making seem to go to whether the officer's conduct was justified, and whether there was the violation of a clearly established right. These arguments as to whether it was reasonable or not, or justified or not, with the material facts that need to be resolved, seems squarely in the realm of qualified immunity and what qualified immunity is designed to address. Why don't we look at this as a qualified immunity instead of absolute immunity as the appropriate doctrine?
Very quickly, with respect to the qualified immunity part of it, I don't think even in that particular case the court performed the correct analysis to determine whether there had been a violation of the constitutional right and a violation of a clearly established right at the time of this particular incident. And they failed to provide the justification for your decision that's been required by Fuentes and other decisions of this court that require that the district court do an analysis on the record in that particular case before it gets to the facts of the
service. Yeah, but how do we know that at this stage in the proceedings? This was done at the motion to dismiss stage. Your requests for immunity were denied at the motion for dismiss stage. All we have in front of the district court is your complaint.
Right, and the complaint is the starting point for doing the analysis. There was no analysis of the complaint on the Iqbal, Twombly, Thomas, or Children's Foundation first, which says, first look at the complaint, see what it says on its face. The only thing the court says that we can point to in the complaint is that the complaint doesn't have enough in it for us to determine whether it's qualified immunity. Well, that usually means that they haven't stated a claim and it should be dismissed. Going back
or
to...
Or how about amended?
Pardon?
What if we determine on qualified immunity that we should send this back to the district court to permit an amendment to the complaint?
I think the determination as to whether at this point, as a matter of law, the complaint states a claim for a violation of the Fourth Amendment is well within the realm of this court to make the decision. With respect to going back to the quasi-judicial immunity question, if I can remember it.
The complaint alleges various constitutional violations. And, you know, I mean, you may have defenses to that complaint, but you haven't had a chance to assert them yet. I mean, I know that you'd like to be able to make the argument that the marshals, when they went out, were advised that he was armed and dangerous. But yet, that's not in the face. That's not in the complaint. It's not in the four corners of the complaint. The court can't look at that.
Right.
So, I mean, why aren't we at a stage in which, you know, you've made the appeal from the denial of qualified immunity. Why aren't we at a stage that's premature for the district court or for us to decide those questions, whatever the label is that you put on it, whether you call it quasi-judicial immunity or whether you call it qualified immunity?
Because I think the averments of constitutional violation are very general, and the purpose of the court's rulings in Iqbal, Twombly, Thomas, and Sherman first is intended for the court to take a look at that complaint and determine whether there's a plausible cause of action there. The court didn't do that, and I think partly because there is none on the face of the complaint. On the face of the complaint, the plaintiffs admit that the marshals were acting in the result of an order of the court, what they call a Pins case. It was actually not a Pins case, but the portion where they say that they were there to bring the court, the juvenile before the court on the court's order is accurate, and that part of it falls within the quasi-judicial immunity realm. The rest of it, where they allege these general constitutional violations, would fall in the qualified immunity realm, but because they're general and because there's not any analysis of what facts were found in support of that, it's now a question of law as to whether the complaint on its face makes out a plausible claim.
How do you get past the fact that they allege that the marshal shot Thompson? He was sitting at home. They allege he was sitting at home. Wasn't harming anybody, and the marshal shot Thompson. I mean, I've narrowed it down to a few points here, but right. It seems to me once they allege that they shot him under these circumstances, you've asserted a constitutional violation.
You've asserted a very general one, and it's not clearly a constitutional violation because the subject of a warrant or a suspect.
But nothing in that warrant said go out and get Thompson, and if you have to, shoot him. Bring him in.
Of course not. And there's nothing in the police manual that says when someone's fleeing from you in a vehicle that you have to shoot them. But the courts have found over and over again that under some circumstances it's reasonable to discharge a firearm.
Isn't that the crux of the matter? Under some circumstances, the use of lethal force is reasonable and is justified. Where we don't know what the circumstances were, at the motion to dismiss stage, we're looking at what was alleged. The district court here did not deny qualified immunity per se. The district court said, we're going to move forward with limited discovery focused on the issue of qualified immunity so that this can be revisited as to summary judgment focused on the qualified immunity issue. District courts do that all the time, and it doesn't mean that qualified immunity is off the table. It means that what is alleged on the face of the complaint, even if fairly bare, still has sufficient allegations set forth in that complaint to state a claim. Why isn't that this case? Why don't we have that here? So that the district court saying, let's have some discovery focused on qualified immunity, and then we'll decide qualified immunity. What is the right approach?
Well, I think 10 depositions later and thousands of dollars spent on disruption of the entire Marshall Division on St. Floyd speaks to why Thomas said that before you go to even limited discovery, you take other steps to determine whether there has been a violation of a clearly established law. The face of the complaint doesn't establish that. If the court needed more information to make the determination as a matter of law, whether a constitutional violation had been alleged, then they should have asked for a more definite statement, or they should have asked the plaintiffs to respond substantively to the motion to dismiss with the precedents that they're relying on to show that there was a violation of clearly established law at the time of this incident.
You initially made the request for a more definite statement, and then you withdrew the request.
Withdrew the request because the court was not responding in a timely fashion, and we had discovery deadlines looming after my stay had been denied. I was caught between a rock and a hard place. It was either proceed with this appeal, which I felt strongly about, or allow the case to languish indefinitely, waiting on the court to rule on my motion.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Rhea?
May it please the court, good morning. As you're well aware, my client was a teenager sitting at home in his underwear, unarmed. There was apparently two court orders that had been issued earlier for him to be picked up so the judge, brought before a judge so the judge could remind him to follow what his mother told him to do. He suddenly, as the marshals come in on his house, while they're sitting there, he tries to escape, and all of this is alleged in the complaint, and as he pushes past the marshals, one of them shoots him. He's now quadriplegic and will be for the rest of his life. The government raises various immunities, and I will speak about each one of them, basically saying that the case should stop here because the marshals were carrying out a function as a public officer pursuant to a court directive. Again, the directive was to bring him before the court, not the shooting, and of course he was sent to Puerto Rico for emergency care rather than brought before a court. Our position, Your Honors, is that Judge Thompson ruled correctly. First, the quasi-judicial immunity issue. There is an immunity for public officials who act pursuant to court directives.
But the directive was not to shoot him, the directive was to bring him into court.
Exactly, Your Honor, and they didn't do that. That immunity is not a blanket permission to do whatever you want while you're carrying out an order. The marshals couldn't have said, let's burn the house down and see if we can drive him out. That would have been a real problem. And they also can't say, well, if you drive him away, let's shoot him. I agree completely with the line of questioning that you raised earlier, and that is the kinds of issues that should be looked at are whether or not there was excessive force. That would cover both whether the qualified qualified immunity should apply or the quasi-judicial immunity should apply.
The Eighth Circuit, looking at the Supreme Court's decision in Morales, has taken the position that absolute judicial immunity does extend to officers who are executing court orders. And based on that same rationale, that is their ability to conduct their jobs without fear of suits and disruption that ensues, why shouldn't we adopt the same position as the Eighth Circuit?
I guess the question becomes, at what point are they no longer carrying out that function? Most of the cases, and many were cited in the briefs, that deal with the issue of what does that immunity extend to, are set there to protect officers carrying out a court order from having been sued for doing that. Basically, the claims being raised are the court order was an improper one, and therefore, since they're carrying out an improper court order, they too should be subject to suit. I agree they shouldn't be subject to suit for directly carrying out the order. The question here is whether or not if they do it in an unreasonable manner, particularly if it's a constitutionally violent manner, such as excessive force, whether or not they can't be getting a blanket to do whatever they want to do and say, no, because I did that when I was carrying out an order, you can't question me about it. I'm totally free of any type of responsibility. I can burn the house down, I can shoot people, I can do whatever I want, and you can't question me about it. That doesn't make any sense. And I think the reason legally it doesn't make any sense is that that's acting sort of outside the scope of reasonably carrying out a court order.
Does it really matter what we call it?
I don't think so, Your Honor. It seems to me that it's result-oriented. It's either you can call it quasi, you can call it qualified immunity. I think it always boils down to the same issue, and that is have they acted in an unreasonable manner in carrying out that order, particularly if it hinges upon the constitutional
right. Did you meet the Twombly-Iqbal standards in your complaint?
I think so, Your Honor. And again, I just draw your attention to items paragraphs 15 and 16 in the complaint, which I think pretty well spell out with some facts, particularly what happened. Briefly, they say, at the time that Marshal Richardson and other marshals arrived at Plaintiff's home and attempted to take him into custody. He was relaxed in his room, in his underwear, and unarmed. Marshal Richardson shot him under circumstances that were unjustified and an excessive use of force. Since the plaintiff Thompson was unarmed and did not threaten bodily harm to the marshals or third parties as he was attempting to run past the marshals.
Why aren't those just conclusory allegations?
Well,
we need specific facts that are alleged that would provide enough to understand whether there has been a violation of constitutional rights and what the contours of qualified immunity defense would look like. How does this provide factual allegations as opposed to legal conclusions?
Well, the factual allegation is that you have him at home, unarmed, not threatening bodily harm, and attempting to run past the marshals. And we know that as a result of that, they shot him. Those are facts.
Even whether he threatened bodily harm, it reads as a conclusory assertion. And while it's not on the record, because we're looking at a motion to dismiss stage, but it appears from other things that have been put before us that the marshals have a different rendition of what happened when and whether they were threatened with bodily harm.
And Your Honor, I think Iqbal and Twombly and the related cases also deal with that issue and say that if there is not enough pled there factually to meet the standard, that the court should liberally grant a motion to amend.
So should we, remand on the qualified immunity issue, should we remand to the district court and instruct the district court to give you an opportunity to amend? How would you plead it if you had an opportunity to amend?
Well, I guess we would just do more wordsmithing and put in more facts. The right now, the way it stands procedurally is that Judge Thompson has basically asked us to conduct depositions, which we have been doing to flesh out the facts, and so she's withheld any ruling one way or the other, and proposed in her order that this might be perhaps right for summary judgment once the facts are fleshed out in the depositions.
Is discovery then at this point complete?
It's supposed to be finished, I think, in the next 2 or 3 days. It's virtually complete, yes. I think we've deposed all the people we indicated to the government. I believe the government's deposed all the people that indicated they wanted to depose of ours. The last of the depositions were completed, I believe, this past Friday. So basically, we have now taken the depositions of all the marshals who were present, the envoy, Thompson, and those were just completed this past week. And I presume in the next day it's going to be those motion for summary judgment on the qualified immunity and other immunity issues which are pending before Judge Thompson. She withheld a ruling asking us to go out and do that, basically to gather the information. So,
given that that's the state of discovery, if we're not satisfied with the specificity of the factual allegations here, would the appropriate course be to remand with instructions, as we've done in some prior cases, for a more definite statement to be elicited, or for the court to simply proceed to address qualified immunity given the record that's been developed?
Both of those would be agreeable to us, Your Honor. I think both of those would make sense. I would suggest that since we simply held any ruling in advance, and it's asked us to do depositions, which we have now just completed, that we'd be permitted to complete the motions process in front of her. She's making a rule on whether or not these various immunities apply based on the fact pattern that's been developed.
I'm not following. What motions are you referring to that were not already addressed and are now before us on appeal?
In Judge Thompson's order that's before you, she declined to rule on the immunity issues, saying that there wasn't enough before her. She then issued an order directing
just qualified immunity.
Just qualified immunity, yes. Right. And with respect to the other immunity, quasi-judicial, she said she wasn't persuaded there was quasi-judicial immunity. I agree with Your Honors, they're very closely related. We have finished the depositions that she asked us to take to develop the fact pattern with respect to those issues. And she is now looking to us to file motions. The government, I presume, will be filing this motion to dismiss based upon the immunities and lay out in that motion the fact pattern that it has developed. And we will be responding by saying, well, here's the fact pattern as we see it, and then Judge Thompson will be ruling. So I think that she's on a track to get us to the same place, which is going to be the factual development of exactly what happened, and then a ruling on the merits.
Not that it makes any difference. I was looking at your brief, and you're not on the brief.
No, I'm not.
Ross Edwards.
Yes.
Is that your appellate counsel, or are you the appellate counsel for Ms. Edwards?
I was not involved in this case until fairly recently, and then Ms. Edwards asked me if I would be willing to be co-counsel with her, and I said yes.
Okay.
So I came into this case fairly late, but I will be trial counsel as well.
What is your position on jurisdiction over the denial of statutory immunity?
I believe I'm agreeing with my brother-in-law in that the jurisdiction, I believe, is, well, I believe that the immunity is a matter of the First Amendment Tort Claims Act through the First Amendment law, not through the 11th Amendment. And I believe that the case that was properly in federal court of dependent jurisdiction because there's a 1983 claim, and I believe it's properly before you because it's a case that's properly before the district court.
On that point, but this is a different aspect of that point, you know, the Virgin Islands Torts Claims Act has some rather specific requirements.
Yes.
And how can we ignore the contents of the statute and not find that the court was in error in not dismissing the complaints for your non-compliance with the statute?
Well, I took a close look at that too, and obviously so did Judge Thompson, and she concluded that there was substantial compliance. And I'll just point out, and know a copy of the notice that was filed is in the record. The notice of intent to file, which was filed in a timely manner, because the incident took place on July 11, 2013. There's a 90-day time frame. And July 23rd, I think it was, or 29th.
I mean, neither in the complaint or in the notice do you specify the total sum of the damages.
Well, that's true.
Well, how can it be a claim? How can either of them be a claim under the statute without specifying a total amount of damages?
The rule for the notice is that it needn't supply either of those two, either the damages,
right,
or damages or the total, but the ultimate claim does. And the complaint itself lists the nature of the damages requested in the addendum portion.
Well, I can see you making the argument that the complaint constitutes the claim.
Yes.
But if you don't specify in your complaint the amount of the damages, I wonder how it meets the statutory requirement.
Well, I can just add also that our local rules forbid us from listing monetary amounts in the complaint and tort actions.
So you're between a rock and a hard place. You failed to file the notice of intent, and you didn't file the claim, and the complaint won't allow you to list damages.
And I think that's probably why the judge said that we were in substantial compliance, because as she viewed it, the main thing we needed to do was to put the government on alert that there's a complaint claim to be filed. And the notice told them the time, the place, the parties, the nature of the claim, personal injury, excessive force, civil rights violations.
But isn't that in order to see if the case will settle before it goes to court? But once it goes to court, aren't there requirements that then need to be met?
Well, the only additional one would be, I believe, the requirement that there be damages listed. And again, I believe that the judge felt that the damages listed in the addendum clause were substantial compliance.
Well, doesn't Section 3410 provide that the notice of intention to file a claim shall set forth these matters accept items of damage or injury and that some claimed need not be stated?
That's in the notice, and yes, exactly. And that's why the notice didn't contain that. Then I believe that same section goes on to say that the claim itself needs to state the damages. So the notice was definitely clearly filed. Judge Thompson viewed, and the case law views, and I just mentioned Brun versus Dowdy as cited in our briefs, views the purpose of these various filings as to put the government on notice that there's an incident that they're looking at potentially being sued so they can investigate. The information in that notice does all of that. It tells them when, where, how, what, who. The government did investigate. There was a police officer there very shortly afterwards. All this was developed in our depositions. They investigated, and the court investigated, and they all issued reports. So all the purposes of the requirements of the Tort Claim Act were met as well.
Is the appellant's challenge here to the claim as in the complaint or to the sufficiency of the notice?
I can't tell you for sure. My sense is that the notice clearly is sufficient, and it's attached to the back of the complaint. The claim itself, which is the complaint, has an addendum clause that meets our local filing requirements for complaints. And Judge Thompson was comfortable that we had substantially complied with the act. I believe to overturn that, he'd have to find that she either abused her discretion in making that determination or was just wrong as a matter of law.
Another question on sovereign immunity. One of your claims is for gross negligence, but as your colleague on the other side of the aisle pointed out, the Tort Claims Act does not appear to extend a waiver to claims of gross negligence. So on that, isn't a reversal necessary because sovereign immunity does apply?
I agree. Yes, that count is improper, it should not be there. No argument that whatsoever. And I don't think my counsel would hire me to be her co-counsel would get mad at me for admitting that. That is clearly true.
Isn't the appropriate way for us to remand for the district court to decide that?
Yes, that would be, but I can assure you that if it is remanded, that I will agree with counsel for the court, for Ms. Richardson, that the gross negligence is precluded under the local tort law.
Okay, thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Jimenez, is your challenge to the claim, to the complaint, and its sufficiency, or to the notice itself?
It's to both, Your Honor. The notice is insufficient and there is no claim. The complaint is not the claim. And there's plenty of case law that says that. For the claim to have been actually filed, for the complaint to be converted to a claim, the Tort Claim Act requires that the plaintiffs ask the court to allow them to do so and have it deemed as such. They've never done that. They've never even addressed it in any of their motions or their responses. They also had an opportunity to cure their defects when the plaintiff Thompson turned 18 because he was under a disability and the Tort Claim Act allowed 2 years for him to correct all the defects, and they never corrected any of them. They never filed a new notice for him, they never filed a claim, they never asked for it.
Okay, isn't the state of the law, the territorial law, the Supreme Court of the Virgin Islands is the one who needs to determine what level of compliance is required under the Virgin Islands Tort Claims Act. Hasn't the, in Fleming versus Cruz, for one case, hasn't the Supreme Court signaled that they're not going to require exactitude and compliance with this statute?
In Fleming versus Cruz, they said you don't have to be, the exactitude is not required, substantial compliance is. But they also signaled that they expected a strict compliance with the statutory requirements of the act in terms of providing notice. And they followed have numerous deficiencies. There's no mention of negligence anywhere in the notice of intention. There's no verification. There's just a dozen or more deficiencies. And the Downey case, I think, signals that based on the Supreme Court's intention to do a strict compliance, that this particular tort claim cannot stand.
Counsel, I know you have asserted that in your brief. What appears if, this is Joint Appendix 28, the notice of intent itself at the bottom appears to be notarized, signed and notarized. Why doesn't that constitute a certification?
Under the local rules of verification is a separate instrument than notification. Verification has particular language that notarization does not. And other documents in other cases have been notarized and have been found to be insufficient because the notary is not a verification. I'm out of time, but...
Thank you for that clarification.
Thank you.
Other questions? Okay. We thank both counsel for their helpful arguments today, and we will take this case under advisement as well.